So in this episode, we speak with Sam Carmani. So he's spoken at TED Talks. He sold 15,000 copies of his book. And he's part of an organization that have done $1.5 billion in transactions. And he talks about the idea of Web 3.0. And it's quite an overwhelming concept for many. But something we discuss throughout this is historic technological advancements. Things to be mindful of from an investment standpoint: don't have all your eggs in one basket, don't speculate so you don't in a position to lose money. But where from a business standpoint, how much money can be made and how worthwhile it is to keep an open mind when these new things arise, because most people are resistant to change. Most people see a new innovation and miss the boat. So this was really, I reached out to Sam. I wanted to know more about Web 3.0. So that's what it's going to be about. And anyone that's listening to this podcast, there's a newsletter where I pull all the information together. I've also got a book that's free. So there's a link in the description if you want to check it out. And there's a bit of information about Sam too. He's got his own podcast. So if you want to see the book, have a look. So without further ado, let's kick into it. Just for the listeners, like, to get a feel for what you actually do at the moment and then why you ended up doing what you're doing at the moment.
Yeah. So currently I do two things. First one, where my full-time job, I work with a company called Moonstream. So moonstream.to. And basically we build the building blocks for Web3 games or blockchain games. So it's like you can call it like a business-to-business product or B2B product. So people use our product to build pay-to-earn games or blockchain-based games. And the other thing apart from that I do is I run a podcast just like you called the Web3 Podcast, where I interview people who work in Web3. So that is all things to do with artificial intelligence, machine learning, blockchain, crypto, all those sort of things, DeFi, and many more, GameFi, and all those sort of things. So yeah, those are the two things, just the two things I do. But I have a varied story. Last 20 years that I've been in New Zealand, I've been over maybe 15 years of that, I've been involved in startups. First startup was in e-commerce space. I own the brand in New Zealand called Herbal Ignite and a few other brands. I co-owned it and grew that quite a bit and then sold it at end of 2015. Interestingly, a few months ago, that the person who bought from us sold it to Just Water, a publicly listed company. So that's that story. After that, I joined an esports startup. There I was their chief operating officer.
Their what officer?
COO.
Oh, yeah.
Chief operating officer.
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
Yep. And with that, I was based in San Francisco for a short time.
What's it like? What's San Fran like? Like, is it
lots of homeless people?
Yeah. Okay. So like extremities, is it like the wealthiest and the worst off?
Yeah, yeah. But the city center is full of homeless people. Wow. A lot more clothes shops.
Why do you think that is?
It is, even when I was there in 2017, 2018, the average or sort of median house price in San Francisco was around $3.2 million or something crazy like that.
Wow.
So most people cannot afford. There's a lot of gentrification. So people have been, so then all sorts of things, all sorts of issues. Mm. But as soon as you go out of San Francisco to like other suburbs outside, it gets very, very different vibe. But it's a very interesting place. It has got a very, very high density of very smart people from all around the world.
Did you ever have like a starstruck moment? You're walking around and you see, like, I don't know how long Steve Jobs passed away, but like, you know, just someone just that was really...
Yeah, I did. So once I was in a... I've been going to US for so many years, since 2007, because even in the previous company used to sell in US, I used to always go to like trade shows, conferences, all those sort of things. And yeah, in San Francisco, quite a few times I've seen, like prominent people, like in the tech industry.
Any gossip? Or you don't want to ruin any ties.
No.
Elon Musk is
no. No, you don't see Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg or anyone like that. They are, especially anyone like Mark Zuckerberg or someone you wouldn't see.
Okay.
The amount of effort they go through to protect their privacy is pretty intense. Yeah, they spend like 29 million Mark Zuckerberg a year on security. So you are not going to see him. So if you do see his picture going in a, you know, like a regular car and wearing regular t-shirt, it's because it has been staged to show people how simple and humble they are. All that is completely staged. There is nothing humble about owning like a massive estate in Hawaii that is size of some small country and owning all the properties around it and stuff so that you have privacy. That is not that is not the lifestyle that they want to portray. They want to portray that, okay, they're just like regular people, normal people. So,
wow, you got it in for Zuckerberg, eh?
No. Just saying yeah, that this is not only him. It is all for everyone. Yeah.
Why do you think they need to do that? Like, I know that we're going to talk about Web 3.0, but I just What makes you think they feel the desire to show a modest life, even though it's inauthentic?
Yeah, because I mean, you don't want to stick out as a like arrogant and stuff. You will only you'll only, people will not like you as much and not want to work with you or in your company or all sorts of things. And you want, like favor from people. Also, it is like a thing that, you know, when you're successful, you want to show the other thing is that it is effortless in a way. So you're like humble, you're just like regular, you're just kind of regular life or growing up or whatever you might call it. You don't want to show the privilege. So there are lots of underlying sort of social reasons why you want to do that.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. So you went over to, you know, America and San Fran, and you saw some homeless people and you saw some big heads, but not the major ones because, you know, they got security of $20 million. What sort of things would you do with this esports company? I mean, we'll move on to the next one.
So with esports, our software would allow people to run tournaments. So basically esports tournaments. So it will allow people to do
Tournaments.
Yeah, so it will allow people to create like brackets. And so if you are in university and you want to run a competition, you could use that, or if you don't run it in your company just as an after hours or in a pub, do FIFA or something. So you do that, and plus there are a lot of other quests and all sorts of things. So it was called uproar.gg, and then that got acquired in 2018. And after that I
didn't agree with new management, probably, I guess.
No, I left just before it got, because it was quite clear that it would either have to do another round of funding. It already had two rounds of funding. It would either have to do another round of funding and go really big, or be acquired by someone to keep it running, because it was a fast moving startup. So those sort of things happen.
Why do you think, you know, because in the tech space there seems to be a lot of desire to get funding. Like it's as though they see money come so easily, so they don't run their business lean, or is it just the nature of technology that you need a lot of injection of cash flow to keep it running? Or
no, it's not that. It is the gospel of growth at all costs. So it's like, you know, because technology, it's a sector which is winner takes it all. The average pay in tech sector is extremely high. You have someone like zero, you know, I don't know, 150K, whatever their average engineer gets paid, and they have 2,000 engineers, so 4,000 engineers. It is a very high resource. So the thing is, with zero, whether 10 businesses use it or 3.3 million, which is their last stat, something use it, they still need the same level of software. So it relies on economies of scale. So the idea is to grow big and completely dominate the market. And it is the same gospel that has been there for since the start of, whether it is through the start of like late 70s, 80s to now, whether it's Microsoft or Facebook or Amazon. It is to completely dominate the market, completely create a monopoly. And if you, the number one book for that is Peter Thiel's Zero to One. And that is that competition is for losers, competition is for suckers. And that's why every these sort of monopolistic company, whether it is Google or Amazon or any of them, they will show on paper, try and show that, look, we have lots of competition. But in reality, they have no competition. Just like Google, for 15 years, it kept on showing that we have so much competition. Only 65% of people use our search engine. But in reality, 98% or 95% use their search engine. Why? Because number one search engine is Google. Number two search engine is YouTube. So when you collect those two, it is 95-98%, something crazy like that. I mean, it's changing now, but not as much. So when you have that sort of, the government would, you know, anti-competition laws and stuff would try and stop, like, those sort of companies, but they always try and show. So this is the number one sign that a company has complete control of the market or not. They will try and show that, oh, we have competition. Whereas on the other hand, companies which have not got it yet, they will show, oh, look, this is how we are different. This is how we are unique. This is how we have a moat around us. And this is how no one will be able to compete with us. They try to show the other way around.
That's an interesting concept, because in essence, you know, similar to what you're talking about, the humility of the leaders. So it's like, when you've got it, you don't need to, you know, pretend like you don't. You actually try and pretend like you don't.
Exactly. You got it.
Yeah.
You got it. That is pretty much what it is. Hmm. Yeah. You got it. Once you've got it, you have to show that it is nothing special. I'm just like regular human being. I have no extra privilege.
Wow.
I'm just a humble, small guy.
Yeah.
That's what you do. And so the same thing, Amazon did the same thing as well. They completely covered the book market. For the first 4 years, they only sold books. They went in that niche. They wouldn't even sell CDs and DVDs when Borders and Barnes and Nobles did all those things. They only did books first 4 years. And once they had the complete monopoly of the market, that's when they introduced other things. That's when they started growing from there on. But the idea is that complete monopoly, complete control. And to do that, you have to grow to be that size. And that's the only time. And that's why first 20 years, Amazon didn't make money. First 20, 25 years, they didn't make money, as in profits.
Yeah.
So if someone just saw their stock price from like 1998 or whatever, whenever they did start, or when it was listed on the market, to it kept on growing regardless of them making not or $0 in profit. It is because the people with the right mind, they could see that what Amazon is trying to achieve. And this is the same gospel that every tech company wants to go towards, whether it is zero or trade me for the New Zealand market or whichever one you take. And yeah, so that's why it's very hard to get economies of scale when you are like small. So growth at all costs, and to get that growth really fast, you raise money.
Yeah, okay. Well, because, you know, you're a big proponent of growth. I think, you know, you attested to that being a really good skill set of yours. You also had a book and you got 111 reviews and 15,000 copies sold. So, you know, something about books. But what do you notice either with a company that's trying to, you know, go zero to one, that book?
Yes.
What do you notice? What happens? Like, do they go through stages of growth and then things could fail that lead them that direction? And then the ones that succeed continue these sort of principles? Do you see a variance between those two?
Oh, yeah. Like, so I didn't actually complete my story of what I did after that.
Yeah, because
that leads to this. Okay. So then I worked with Will Smith, who's the co-author of that book. And we...
Will Smith. Yeah, it sounded like you said Will Smith.
Yeah. It's very similar name. Yeah, very, very similar name.
Oh, yeah.
So we ran sort of an agency where we built MVPs or minimum viable products.
Yeah.
For people, so worked with lots of entrepreneurs and stuff and all that. So did that for a few years, 2-3 years, while writing books, speaking at events and all that. And so I've had the privilege to work with so many founders and see the ones that they succeed. I mean, I would have now talked with literally over the last 15 years, thousands of founders, and met them whether on Zoom or in person or events and stuff, and see what the successful ones do and what the non-successful ones do. Back to your question is like, what do the companies that can go from zero to one do well? At early stages, the biggest impact is the founder and the founding team, because there is no product, there is no service, you know. So it's all comes down to that, and to their sort of ambition and the grit at what, how much grit they have to make it, to do what it takes. A lot of people who want to build a tech startup, what they do is that they go and hire someone to, you know, write the software for them or whatever for their idea. That is very similar to like me paying someone to go to gym for me, so and expecting results. And so so the thing is that, okay, that's fine, you don't have to have all the skills, so you find the co-founder or find and build a team around you to do it yourself in-house, because then you and your team get the learnings from it. So that is sort of the number one thing at the early stages.
Okay.
I would say. And most of the people would be at early stages, because if they are at later stage, they are Amazon, they don't need to listen to us. They have done it. So yeah, I think that that would be the main thing. And the thing is that most people will say, oh, like, I have no co-founder, I have no team, I have, and that's where sales comes in, because you have to sell your idea. If you cannot sell your idea to one person, how are you gonna sell it to a million? You know, you have to be so passionate about it, you have to be so engrossed in that whole thing, in solving that problem, that people are attracted to you, that people are like, look, I have to help Ryan with his mission to achieve this, otherwise, you know, the world is incomplete. They have to believe in whatever you're trying to sell so much. So yeah, so
I agree. There's I used to help with the training and direction of a team of 15. I was commissionally selling, and one of the concepts they would always teach us was people won't get on a bus if they don't know where it's going.
Yeah,
it's the same thing, that vision component.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. And then it becomes a matter of hiring people that are good at the things you don't like, as well as hiring on values and vision. So not hiring them on forcing to your vision, but your vision will help them achieve theirs.
Exactly right.
Because I think that's a mistake a lot of business owners have, is assuming people want to work as hard as them or as passionate about their goal, as opposed to hiring people that actually just want to fulfill their own needs and their own vision.
So, but it's a different thing with the tech startups and also Web3 startups, is that you get a stake in the company, so it becomes part of your thing.
So is that a common model?
It is a very common model.
Okay.
All our early employees. So whenever like a tech startup gets an exit, the first 1,000 employees rake it in. It's like Kareem, the Uber of... Dubai or UAE, when that got acquired, it created 1,000 plus millionaires. So every time there has been an exit, and there's been thousands and thousands of exits in Silicon Valley, and every time there's an exit, it births like a thousand or few thousand millionaires who then go and invest in more tech startups and who build more companies and who so that is the reason why the property prices are so high, or they have been for the last 20 years in San Francisco compared to anywhere else in the US.
Makes sense.
So yeah,
I wonder if, you know, like, because the bar is so high in terms of an income and they can go anywhere and find it. I wonder if that's in the incentive, you know. It's like, hey, we're just starting, we've raised some funds, and, you know, we can pay you somewhat, but what you're going to be a part of is the equity in the company, and then you're going to benefit in the long term. Do you 100%. Think that's a contributor?
Oh, yeah, yeah, 100%. Okay. Yeah, 100%. So, yeah. And it is part of the package. Just a few months ago, when it was the height of the stock market, crypto market, all the markets, like a few months ago, it was very common for people to get in US 500,000-600,000 annual pay plus stock plus other benefits and stuff. So it's like $1 million was becoming kind of like in the higher end, really really sought after people, was becoming the norm in technical world. So yeah, if anyone's got kids, teach them coding, teach them software development.
What sort of coding? Either Python, or what do you think's the future of artificial intelligence? Trying to understand that.
The thing is that just any, because if you are skilled in how computers talk, then you will pick up whatever the next thing comes in. So that's fine. Just start creating, start building something, create a game, create a web page. Doesn't matter. Just start, you know.
So I suppose it's, yeah, it's like the curiosity and then the framework. So you understand this, it's transferable to that.
Yeah.
Do you, just like Web3, I've been struggling to find anyone to talk about Web3 at Go because they don't have their fucking, they don't have, I swear on this, just
go ahead, FYI. Yeah.
But they don't have like their numbers anywhere. They're like incognito and then they're making all this money. And I was like, what are these, you know, so there's non-fungible tokens, there's blockchain, there's, what do you sort of like to help our simple listeners and simple me? There's probably smart listeners, but. What's the basics of Web 3.0 and what should we be mindful of if we're either a business owner
so
or
so much. I don't know where to go. How many days have you got for this? Okay, let's just start with the start of the web.
Yeah.
And just thinking. Okay, so web one, mid 90s to sort of 2005, let's say, or early 90s to 2005, most of the websites were sort of like static, or it is just read and write. So you can write blogs, you can read blogs, you can do all those sort of things, chat, all that stuff. So that's how I call it, like the read and write web. That was web one. Web two was sort of the rise of social media. You not only read and write, you also share. And that sort of exponentially grows everything because you're now sharing and commenting and doing all those sort of things. So that gave rise of all the social media giants that we see today, whether it is Facebook or YouTube or you know, Twitter and LinkedIn and so many others. But the thing is that when you participate in Web 2, as it is called now, I mean, it didn't used to be, all this is terminology, it's just come up in the last year or two.
Yeah.
But yeah, as it is called Web 2, when you participate in Facebook, you are the product and you're contributing to running the company by putting messages up there, by putting videos up there. And in most cases, Facebook is not paying you in any way. You are not getting paid in shares of Facebook for doing that, for participating and building that company from ground up by putting a message in every day, checking it every day for the last 5, 10 years, 15 years. This all changes in Web3. And what happens is in Web3, you also own the more you participate. To give you an example, companies like, let's say, Facebook 2.0, has, which is a Web3 startup, they will have their own tokens, their own currency. And the more you participate, the more you share, the more it will give you their own tokens. So you'll earn those tokens. And these tokens will be then traded on a decentralized exchange or a DeFi exchange or decentralized finance exchange. So then you can change it to real currency or Ethereum or Bitcoin or whatever, whenever you want it. Or you can lend that money that you have made these tokens to someone, or you can stake them, or you could do all sorts of things with it. Now that makes, all this makes it super, super dangerous as well, because suddenly there is money associated where it was not. And you don't know how this money will be used. You don't know what will happen to that. And then some people see that the price of that, because a lot of people are engaging in one particular social network or game or whatever it might be, whatever platform, and however they decided to reward you, then some people might not participate and just start buying those tokens. And then the price might speculate and go up and down. And so whenever things go up and down, some people are going to lose money, whether it's in stock market or crypto market, doesn't matter. Some people are going to make money as well. Those who are in the know are going to make more, and some who are not, who are just getting caught in the hype, are going to lose. And so this is the whole phenomenon of Web3. Sort of, it is decentralized. It has been made possible because of the blockchain, or the blockchain technology. So it is now read, write, share, and also own. So the own part is the new part. And how world will react to it, how world will engage in it, it's about to be seen.
Yeah. Well, that is a very concise, beautiful way to describe it. I look at it from like a financial planning standpoint, is when there's any new technological advancement, there's greed and fear.
Yes.
So like, for example, when the automobile was first made, there was 1,900 automobiles that came out, companies, and they're like, oh yeah, they're going to be successful, and people speculated. And then you had, you know, only three car companies survive in the US.
Yes.
The dot-com bubble, where you talked about Amazon first, when the internet came out, everyone was speculating, thinking they're going to get a whole lot of money. And then, you know, 1% of people made a lot of money, 99% of people lost money.
Yeah.
So that's always been my concern from an investment standpoint.
Yeah.
But from a business standpoint, I think there needs to be a curiosity around it.
Yeah.
Because when Facebook first came out, they're like, oh, it's just for college kids.
Yeah. When YouTube was for cat videos. I don't know if you remember that.
I don't remember that, but I know LinkedIn and TikTok and Instagram, they all said, oh, it's a waste of time. My clients aren't on there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember I did Google Ads in 2003 and 2004 when they were really new.
Yeah.
And I was buying ads, and I turned around a few businesses, couple of businesses, and that's how I got my first break. Because I came here as an international student, and then as an immigrant, I had like, I just had a student loan. That was my asset. I mean, just liability. No.
Yeah.
So I had to build everything. So that's what I did. And I always adopted the newest technology first. And every business that I talked to help them out initially said that, oh, all my clients are looking at Yellow Pages. Why would I want to go to... This is 2004. You have to take it in that context.
Yeah, so they were not wrong.
Why would I want to put, $5 a day on YouTube... Google Ads. You could get thousands of views and insane amount of business for $10 back then, because it was few cents ad, because no one was doing it. And why would I want to spend that $10 there when I can spend $2,000 a month on a Yellow Pages ad? It's like, you know, that's what they're that's what they were thinking. And so I turned around a couple of businesses, and that's how I got recommended, and I got into my sort of first business and first company and stuff. This has happened over and over and over again. Yeah. So whenever a technology is new, you go in there, you will get really underpriced attention, and you'll get underpriced assets, just like a new subdivision opening up in a town that you can see is going to develop because there's an airport and a port that it's connected to the world.
Sound like Gary Vee, mate. Underpriced attention. Do you know Gary Vee?
Yes, I do know. But that is just the reality, and that is the same thing with the Web3 as well. Talking about the dot-com bubble and the boom, it's like how many multi-billion dollar startups have been born out of Silicon 100%. Valley? So the thing is that people only look at the boom and bust. They don't have the right point of view of looking at boom and bust. People always talk about tulip mania. I'm sure you know about tulip mania. But what people don't realize into tulip mania is that it was a very short-lived episode, and it only negatively affected a few hundred people or something at that time. But because of that, it caused so much hype and attention at that time in the cultivation of tulips and cultivation of flowers, that for the next 200 years after that, Netherlands completely ruled. And even to this day, 60-70% of the flower trade is ruled by one country, and that's Netherlands.
I didn't know that.
And so it built trillions of dollars of wealth and hundreds of thousands of jobs over that time for their country. And it sort of propelled their economy forward. It's like we had the dairy booms and busts in New Zealand as well. And it created thousands of jobs and tens of billions of dollars every year. So whenever there is a boom, it sucks up all the talent. And when you have a high concentration of talented people, beautiful things happen. And it creates industries, it creates productivity. Same thing has happened in the Silicon Valley. They could have all given up and gone home after the dot-com bubble burst in 2001. But in the last 20 years, 60-70% of all unicorn startups in the world come out from Silicon Valley, because there is a high concentration of really smart people, and thousands, not few, like 5-10 like New Zealand, thousands of probably unicorns have been born out of that region. Just one small region, which is size of like Auckland region, you know.
Yeah.
So it just and those startups have created wealth for people all around the world by increasing productivity. So whenever you are using your computer, you are using increased productivity, doing more with less employees, it has added wealth and value to your workflow. Mm-hmm. And so it's like it is easy to just look at the very small negative effect of that time, which is the boom and bust things cause. But yeah, it's like if not for the gold rush, there would be no California, you know. Yes, and a lot of people did lose money in gold rush as well. Most didn't make money in every gold rush.
I think it's important to make the distinction is that I think for any great initiative, whether it's the automobile, whether it was, you know, tulips, whether it was the .com, it was really just from from an investment standpoint, not being diversified. So from a business standpoint, I think you're stupid if you're not curious. That's why I called you. I was like, I feel like an absolute peasant when I talk about Web 3.0.
Yeah.
So I thought I got to be curious because I think it's human nature. There was a doctor, I can't remember the specific study, but he told people that, hey, if you don't change your habits, you're going to die. And 10% of them changed. So humans don't like change. And I think we got to acknowledge that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess some people don't mind. Some people like they don't want to be anchored down to odd.
And, it's all they want.
And they are like nomads and they just wander the looking for the new thing. They don't care. They don't mind. But most people don't like change because it's your comfort zone. Why do you want to go out of your comfort zone? It's so nice and cozy. So I was talking to you about like the whole sort of the boom and bust, and that's it's just that whenever a boom happens, it sucks up all the talent. And if you look at the biggest of the cities that have had a massive impact on the history of our world, they were the centers of civilization where people went from all over, whether it was Constantinople or Istanbul of now or any in the Middle East or Babylon or Athens or the most educated people from all around the world would gravitate there because like minds, they want to spend time with other people who understand them and create things like algebra or calculus and things like that. And
quite knowledgeable, mate, your history.
And so, so that's just what happens. And that's what happened with Silicon Valley. And that's what happened like with New York. It sucked up all the financial talent and a lot of financial innovation, good and bad, came through there. Same thing is now happening with Web3, but Web3 is like everything else on steroids because those were limited to geographic location. Web3 is so decentralized that everyone I talk is some other part of the world every single day. All my company, we don't have a physical office. We don't have this. You know, everyone works from their home in a different country. Nearly every single person is in a different city. And most of us are in different countries through different time zones. So previously, we had to go to that one geographic location. Now that one geographic location is the internet. And that's why things in Web3 move 20, 30 times faster than the regular tech startups do. And the speed at which innovation is happening, it is so rapid. It is so fast. I feel like I cannot keep up, even though I spend all my time on internet reading and talking with some of the smartest people in the world. It's very, very interesting time. At the moment in Web3, it feels like it is just like the birth of the internet. It feels like that. Everything happening.
Ah, what do you, so people hear this, they get excited and they're like, I want to do something, but you know, I feel a little overwhelmed at the idea. Like what are some, I guess, tangible applications businesses, at least in New Zealand, should be curious about, like what they should be thinking just so they don't become that rigid person that was a naysayer when the tulips came and was a naysayer when New York started taking off and.
Let me. Think about, okay, so first thing is that the only investment advice I would ever give is to invest in yourself. So invest in educating yourself, sort of. That would be the first thing.
Where do we go? Where do we learn this stuff?
Okay, the easy answer is I try and simplify everything in my podcast and share it. But there are lots of books and podcasts and resources online. It is very hard. I wouldn't listen to anyone who is giving directed advice that go and buy this token or go and buy this asset or going buy this. I would never say that, you know, I think that is a bit disingenuous because I don't have a crystal ball where I can see that go and buy this, because no one knows who is going to be the GM, Ford, and Chrysler of this era. You know, no one knows who's going to be the Amazon, Microsoft, and Google of Web3 yet. I mean, everyone has their speculations, but we are in so early stages that, yeah, so it's like we can't know that. But what we can know is that this field is a lot more community driven. So any project or any industry you are in, so law, there is massive implications for law in Web3. If you are in medicine, every pretty much field in the world has massive implications where there is a huge cross-section of Web3. So look at what Web3 project there is, or write blockchain and write your industry name. See who is working in that field. Go and join. They all have a Discord server. You can talk with their community, see what they're building. Join some of these communities in your field, because it does not matter. You are in property. Someone is tokenizing that property and selling that on the internet right now using Web3. Give you an example. It is like, say you have a house. It is worth $800,000, but it is, most people don't have that sort of money, but most people have $800. So you divide it into 1,000 tokens and sell each token for say 900 and bank some extra, and then everyone who holds this token holds them in like a DAO, which is a decentralized autonomous organization, and so the rent that comes in goes into that DAO, and then that gets split out to everyone that is a token holder with them. So there's going to be pretty much nearly no aspect of our economy that won't be touched by Web3 in the next 15 years, 10 or 15 years. That was just one example. But then all this creates so much work for lawyers, because they will have to figure out, you know, how to do this. There'll be a work for accountants, because they will have to do the accounting for all this, and how will this correspond to regular banking and all that. So there will be a lot more jobs. It's like back in 1950s, they used to say that, oh, we've got now vacuum cleaner and washing machine and all these things, and so we won't have to work even 2 hours a day, and we'll just be able to relax, and someone will cook for us, like the machines will cook for us and feed us, and they will do all the work. And so it does not work like that. In fact, we have a staff shortage in nearly every industry in every country in the world. So there is going to be a lot more opportunity and a lot more jobs.
Sounds like it. I'm just going to push this as I talk.
Yes.
Because the interesting thing, like taking the accountants, for example, there's an aspect of their job that is continually being replaced, which is the processing of compliance, taxation. It's a lot of it is automated, but the component is similar to how they first invented a chess algorithm that could help win, and it would beat most human players, but when you combined it with another human, you know, the cyborg approach, so that would be quite a worthwhile endeavor, where the accountant is using the streamlined efficient process of blockchain decentralization, but actually acting as more of a coach in the directive side. So utilizing technology not out of fear but out of efficiency, so you can focus on what you're good at. What would you think in a law, like pick an industry that you're interested in, where would be some fun applications? Like maybe the music industry, where you have a built-in smart contract that pays out royalties each time it's unsold.
It is happening in music industry in big time through NFTs and all that. And there was this idea of 1,000 true fans. I don't know if you've heard of that idea. So the 1,000 true fans is that you only need 1,000 true fans to make a living.
Oh, yeah.
Web3 is sort of, everything is on steroids in Web3 pretty much. It's like the idea is that 100 true fans. You have 100 true fans, you can sell them like $1,000 NFT, and if they are the NFT holder, you have a Zoom meeting with them once, and or you sing them a happy birthday, or they get all these special privileges, or they can have a coffee with you once every 2 years or something like that. You can give them access, or once a year, and all these benefits, or they'll come and play at your birthday or something. So you can have a 100k sort of a sustainable income even with just 100 fans. and that's what was not possible before. Previously, you had to have millions of downloads on Spotify or somewhere to make even a small amount of money. So Web3 is completely changing by giving access and ownership and tokenization. You know, whenever there is innovation in money, it completely changes. It adds steroids to any economy. And we saw that with the East India Company, which was the first company to sort of not tokenize, but what do you call, offer shares in there or raise money. Or that was sort of the start of like the public markets back in once again in Netherlands or Amsterdam.
Oh yeah, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
So they were the first company, and they were in today's money they would be worth something like $11 or $12 trillion. So they were the first company to offer debt and all sorts of raise money using bonds and all sorts of things like financial innovation. They were the first one to do that. Then they raised that money to buy the ships and go and do that. So,
and then came back with nothing. They bombed, didn't it, that one?
I think so. Then they raised money again.
I'm pretty
again.
Sure they bombed, because they went there to get all, like, everyone's like, yes. They'll type it up. Oh, we're going to go get all these spices, this cool stuff. And then they came back and like, oh, yeah. My bad.
I mean, they did lots of evil stuff. Don't get me wrong. I know that like from the history.
Yeah.
But that was the start. And you know, how many companies have stock markets all around the world, 195 countries have supported and built?
Yeah.
How many employees work there?
Sure.
So as soon as something like this, whenever innovation of money happens, it just opens up.
Mm.
It opens up the floodgates of employment.
Mm.
Same thing is happening with Web3. That was limited to the stock market. Now it is in anyone's control. And that's the example as gaming in the industry, which I work in.
Mm.
And I'm seeing it more and more, where games create their own sort of tokens or currency and reward their players, and players exchange items in game with themselves or in the open market and stuff. So, but that won't be just limited to gaming. The innovation is starting in gaming, but it will move on to property and all sorts of other assets and stuff. Pretty much nearly every asset, there is someone building a Web3 startup in that you can think of.
Yeah. Well, just on that, I mean, we're just the tail end of this. Just on like if people wanted to either reach out for you for a particular thing, or if they want to be a part of that business that you're an employee at as well, what should they do, or where do they find you?
Yeah, so they can just search for my name and on any channel like LinkedIn or Twitter, or my DMs are always open, or look for my podcast. I talk a lot about Web3 stuff and the opportunities in Web3. So you just search for my name on Spotify or Apple Podcast, and reach out to me, DM me. Very happy to talk about any opportunities in Web3 or guide you in the direction.
Cool, bro. Well, yeah, it was definitely an interesting subject, and I sort of have to force myself to be open-minded, because I'm just aware, like, the amount of, I guess, lack of better word, hate I get for using TikTok and the non-believers, even though it's like working. And I just got to apply that to Web 3.0, where, you know, when there's innovation, it's a resistance to change.
Yeah.
And if you are the person that's curious in those moments and first to market, and you know, as you say, use that 0-1 mindset.
Yeah.
You can make a meaningful contribution.
Yeah, and it's just that innovation is not going to stop or wait for anyone. It will keep moving, and so I mean, you've done amazing stuff on TikTok. You're doing so well.
Thanks.
And the window of opportunity is quite small.
Yeah, it is,
because the thing is, when later on, as soon as corporates and companies jump in, they'll be a lot more polished, and then you'll have so much more competition to compete for the same attention.
Yeah.
So once again, it is the underpriced attention.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah.
Same thing Amazon, you know, they bulk bought Google AdWords at the time when you know it was important, but we gotta wrap it up. Thank you for coming, Sam, and I found it interesting, and if you want to reach out to him, check out the podcast, it'll be in the link below, and cheers.
Thank you I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, me too.
About all this stuff.
yeah I love learning. All right, well, there, boom.